Hello everyone, I'm Anne Flaherty and welcome to a very special interview from the Irish Cultural Centre in Hammersmith. Before we begin, we have a small favour to ask. We had a host of fundraising activities and celebrations planned to mark our 25th anniversary, but unfortunately these are on pause due to the impact of COVID-19. We remain as keen as ever to continue sharing the best of Irish culture with you, particularly through this difficult time. But we do need a little help. If you enjoy today's interview or have enjoyed any of the great content from ICC Digital or ICC on the radio or our culture hotline over the last several months, we would be hugely grateful if you would consider texting 70450 with ICC5 to donate £5, ICC10 to donate £10, or ICC25 to donate £25. Your donation will help support our work in the community, as well as ensuring that we can continue to create brilliant content to share with you all. We can't wait to welcome you back to the centre when it is safe to do so. But for now, it is my great pleasure to introduce today's guest, stand-up comedian, television presenter, bestseller writer, and very importantly, an ICC patron, Dara O'Brien. Welcome, Dara, and thank you for joining us today.
No, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, ordinarily, of course, we'd be doing this interview face-to-face at the ICC Centre or a hall somewhere. And I'm just wondering, can you tell us how has the lockdown affected you and your plans for work over the past year or so?
Well, look, ordinarily I wouldn't do things face-to-face. I insist on there being some form of barrier, some form of shield. A confessional booth is my preferred location for an interview. I like the separation and I like the degree of formality involved in that. Also, there's a whole power structure thing about who's the priest in this and who's not the priest. So,
I can't be because you know we can't have women priests, so I'm obviously ruled out.
Yeah, you're right. So, okay, true. And actually, to be honest, or atheist priest, I think is also a bit of a giveaway. So, I think neither of us get to be the priest, but still, inherently, there's an element of one person is in the lower, the person the other. Has it changed things? The lockdown ended my career essentially. There is a thing I say that there's a real clear split between ice flows a break between younger comedians who went, okay, fine, now I'm going to learn to do TikTok and I'm going to reinvent myself in the visual arts and I'm going to do Zoom gigs and I'm going to find ways of delivering content on different media platforms. And then there were slightly older comics who went, so this is what retirement is like. Okay, I'll go into the garden now for a while and pick up a hobby. Ed Byrne is making things out of cedar wood in his house. Lee Mack is gardening. Other comics I'm speaking to. I bought various telescopes and take photographs of things and pore over them for hours, trying to do, you know, Photoshop on them to get the levels of new. It's nonsense. I'm not get into why, but it's incredibly compelling. There's a set of skills that I got trained for, which really only work in front of a whole group of people. And I have been denied the chance to use them for a year now and possibly a year and a half. The most dramatic part of it is that I was literally on the way. I just finished my first ever tour of America, 4 dates in America. I was about to do my first ever tour of Canada. I was very excited about this and was in the airport about to check in when the call came. This is the 12th of March, something going, this has all been pulled. So I had to do a mad dash from LaGuardia Airport to JFK Airport, which are luckily both on the same side of New York, and hop into a taxi again, and then go all the way across and then race to the British Airways counter and essentially bluff my way onto a plane and go, I need to get back to London. I was supposed to be getting a flight from Toronto in 2 weeks' time. Can I use it on this flight? And the kind person in BA said, of course you can. There's no problem at all. Look, I've got you onto a plane. It leaves in 45 minutes. And I then found myself having to go, I didn't mean the flight in about 2 hours' time. I knew you've got about four flights. I don't want the one. I'm not in that much of a rush. I'd like to get a meal and do some duty free. But I'd made such a fuss of, I need to go back to London, that for no reason, I had to run through the airport to get the plane 35 minutes later and then arrived onto the plane sweating and breathing heavily, which is exactly what everyone presumed a COVID patient looked like last March. And I'm there dripping and heat coming off me and everyone else in the plane going, no, they were stuck with him for 6 hours. This is wrong. But yeah, as it turns out, false alarm. So it was very dramatic at the start and then swiftly followed by a year of doing nothing.
Absolutely. Well, you know what they say, never waste a crisis, you know, when there's an opportunity. Look,
if there's a thing in it, if there's a rush across an airport that they can dramatize for no effect. Mm. Yeah. I mean, but other than that, like there's been, you know, because all live went and then briefly reappeared for the summer in either in front of cars, weirdly, or in socially distanced gigs where people were sitting in like ferry fort, like, you know, the things, the ferry rings that people would draw on the ground. They all had their own little ones of those, and they'd sit in a big field somewhere. And then and we pushed them really to the start of October, where it was getting very cold to sit outdoors for 2 hours of a show. And then it became this, we can't do this now. So no one's done a live gig. We've done mock the week.
Yes, with screens.
We did, and we did them. We briefly had about 3 weeks where we had an audience in the room and they were sitting out in a kind of a socially distant way. And that actually was worse than the Zoom, because there was, instead of being, it's an old rule of physics that it's always better to have the audience rammed into a room. Like when we book Edinburgh's, when you're working your way up the level of Edinburgh, there's some point where you go back a size of room so that your audience is a little bit too big for it. So suddenly you're selling out. And it's a bit of a cheap trick, but it works, because a packed room of 60 is better than a half full room of 300, weirdly. And so we found ourselves in Mock the Week, suddenly our 250 seats were filled with 80 people, and it was distanced and a bit awkward. Everyone's wearing masks. And so it became better just to focus on the Zoom crowd, because we had the intimacy of being in their homes. Which was, you know, they all kind of got a bit giddy about it. There are people who could never have traveled down to London normally to see a show. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of a general, really upbeat festival. And they're sitting in their houses, is the thing they've been looking forward to for weeks. So it was an extra treat for them. But it was a, it made it, and there was a kind of a tension with it, which is what you want to play with. I'm sorry, while you were doing this, my wife is tippy-toed into the room to take the computer game that my son wants to play, is now tippy-toeing out of the room. Snapshots of life.
Could be worse. Could be a cat.
It could be. Well, honestly, I had to expel the cat a few minutes beforehand. But there was a tension. There was a tension from people sitting in the front rooms and us talking down the thing directly at them, actually being able to see them for the first time, which made it funny in itself. I used to tell them to go and find a weapon. That was one of the things we did one week. Go find a weapon. And then they'd produce knives and stuff like that. One guy had a crossbow in his house. Or they'd hide. I'd say, everyone hide. And then we'd do a bit where I'm going, hey, where have the audience gone? And it would be just empty seats. And then they'd all emerge from behind their chairs, like whatever. So it became a kind of a giddy, a kind of high, you know, upbeat kind of a fun. It was, honestly, for a show that has weirdly a lot of baggage about it, Mock the Week, we were having a lot of fun and ended up being a very fun series. But it's the only thing I've been able to do for the last year.
Just thinking there about what you said about, you know, about being in the middle of a big tour or whatever, and about to do a trip to Canada. Those big tours that you do, where you do, you know, you might do 150 nights, not forgetting 37 nights in Vicar Street. But it's really hard to actually imagine what that was like, or to envisage that happening in the near future, isn't it? It's the idea of sitting next to strangers and having, you know, what, you can't have people doing lateral flow testing on the way in, you know, by the thousands.
Yeah, I think it's
terrifying.
It's easy for me to imagine doing it than it would be for the audience, I think.
Yes. Well, yes. You'll be maintaining a social distance.
I will, and I'll be mainly expelling droplets of water at people, rather than being the one having to absorb them. And also I am aching for a night away from home.
Everybody else, Dara, by the way.
I know, but you know, it's been, and like, you know, we did get away. We got over to Ireland during the summer, like, and sneaked into the place. We've had the odd, you know, trip when it was possible to travel, but. This at some point in March, the 12th of March, whatever I presume it is, or the 13th, yeah. I've spent 364 out of 365 days under the same roof as my family, and I haven't done that in 25 years. And it's, you know, they're all suffering for it now. And so you kind of get used to a life where you just have these windows of travel built in, which are like a valve. And if you're the kind of person who needs that, yeah. So that's been slightly weird, but. That part of it, I seem to be going back to easily. Writing is also an issue. As in, what the hell do you write about?
Yes, what are you going to write about? Because in the kind of observational comedy that, you know, that you're writing, surely that really relies on, you know, interacting with people, at the very least. And not only that, what are you going to write about after a lockdown?
Well, that's,
can you
that's
write
the major
jokes
dilemma.
About it or
you,
not?
Well, you can. Well, you can write jokes about it, but the thing is, everyone else is writing jokes about it. We haven't found that there's been any. Weirdly, there was a episode of Mock the Week where we did. Every first, the way the structure works is basically there's a long chat block and then there's some standing bits and then another long chat block. So there's two large blocks. I mean, generally there's one story for each, either a photo or a picture of the week or something, and it gets us into a chat, right? So there's two long blocks. The first block every week for this block was COVID and vaccines and situation, right? The second block was invariably America, just because that was a big story in January. And and there was one week where we did our response to the Capitol, the riots in the Capitol. And two people on Twitter said, well, you've crossed the line there. You know, people died. And I went by going, we did 10 minutes about COVID just before that. But suddenly these individuals dying has affected you slightly more than the 10,000 people who died in the UK of this thing. People were absolutely, look, I think there is a human scope for dealing with tragedy and comedy and putting those two things beside each other far finer than we give ourselves credit for. So so that part was it'll be okay. I don't think anyone's going to go, how dare you joke about this?
No, I mean more sort of an apathy. Forget about it?
That is absolutely the problem with it, which is that I think there's a point where right now all we see is lockdown. But afterwards, we will not want to think about lockdown at all. That's one theory. The other theory is that it'll take some disseminating, and there should be some cultural artifact to it, because interestingly, there's plenty of films about the First World War, but no films about Spanish flu, because Spanish flu doesn't have an enemy, and so therefore it kind of disappeared from our cultural landscape. And then this thing suddenly roars back in, and it reminds me what a pandemic is. But pandemics don't make great films, and so they are great art to a certain extent, in the same way. So, but there has to be some sort of cultural artifact,
a shared experience.
There is, and there has to be some chronicling of that. But I think that's, I kind of feel we've all so exhausted of it now that what we want is something different. I think it's going to go silly, personally. I think it's going to go, people will just want to be out in a room and just enjoy the madness of being in a room together. And I think that's something that taps into that. So, I think you may get an interesting generation of, in the way that people said, you know, there are certain types of government create punk or create angry pop music. This might create very silly comedy, very kind of just a total relief of, look, isn't it great just to be out and here's some nonsense. So I think I think we'll tend towards the nonsense. But like what you write, because observational stuff is, I generally write story, I tell stories of things that happened to me. Nothing's happened. So it's a very difficult thing to do. Or you'll chat, I don't know. I mean, the gigs that I've done, the one thing that's really characterised the gigs I've done is a slightly manic energy for me just from being on stage. And that has been the defining thing, is that I can't remember what material I chose to do. They're just jokes. Ultimately, they're just the delivery. They're just bullets in the gun, as I used to say. But it was just being on the stage, the giddiness. That was the funniest thing about it. It was like, oh my God, look at this. This is happening again. It's great to hold a mic in my hand. And the audience were just the giddiness of being out, of being, oh my God, we're at a gig. How amazing is this? And so I think that'll carry a bit of it. Just how weird is this? Wow, how great. We're doing this again. So I think there's going to be a bit of we're doing this again.
Yes. On the other hand, the one thing that has happened throughout this whole, you know, lockdown is the interest in science, because now we're looking to science to get us out of it. And wearing your other hat, you know, that must be something you personally at home are probably, you know, crunching the numbers and looking at, you know, vaccine statistics and all sorts of things all the time. So that is, for example, I think nobody knew what an epidemiologist was before this.
And now,
certainly couldn't spell it.
Everyone is an epidemiologist.
They are the rock stars.
Yes, well, everyone has a guitar at home and comes they can play it. There are a lot of air guitar epidemiologists, rock stars, let's say, on Twitter. I'm very happy to go that that's not a field of science I know much about. So I'm always very happy to look, as I do anyway. One of the things I'm very happy to go, they discovered it. I'm just a guy telling you about it, about this. I wouldn't say it's been a golden era for science, because it has brought up as many people just giving nonsense as anything else. I mean, in a sense, historically, yes, it will be, because they have managed to create a vaccine in ridiculously fast times with new methods involving RNA and manipulation and all these kind of things have been brilliant. They've mapped things and genome things. And it's like, yes, it is a snapshot of how far we've come as a species that we've done this so well. But in terms of the public discourse, it's not like people going, hey, we should be, let's be quiet now and let these people know more about this than we do. Have you heard that at any point? These people know more than we, let's let them talk for a while. Like, instead, no, it's been Toby Young on Newsnight. Like it's like the media can't shift its desire to have balance in quotation marks. And that's all very well, Mr. Head of Epidemiology. But now we have a guy who thinks lockdowns kill more people than the virus, and you're going, but they really don't. We can show you a chart. I don't think it's been in that regard in terms of the public use of science. I suppose we've found ourselves as prone to just the garbled version of it that you get from people who just want to grab a thing that backs up what they wanted to say. So that's still a thing.
I think in general, you know, in terms of the ordinary member of the public, I think there's a huge admiration and thankfulness, really, for having the science. You know, I mean, that is the feeling that without that, where, you know, how do we get out of this? And surely that must be useful for you as a person who is engaged in promoting science, and particularly, you know.
Absolutely. There is. I mean, again, people are talking about things that they weren't talking about. I mean, but just for particularly serious reasons, I suppose. But but I suppose there is. I mean, and we're watching a live experiment taking place in how you, like, in terms of public health, taking place in 187 countries at the same time. I mean, that in itself is incredibly interesting. I started this habit very early in the thing. I'd go to the Johns Hopkins website, and that's the one that has a map of all the countries, and then you can just bounce on it and go to country, and it has cases, deaths, all the stuff, like, whatever. And I pored over that, like, at a time when it wasn't particularly good for your mental health to do that, as it was expanding up. And then I just posted the other day that, look, the global cases are falling away. And then, you know, people going, yes, but it's winter, Dara. And I would go, yes, it's a globe. It's not winter everywhere.
It's not winter.
But it's winter in the places where you're going, you know, it's not winter in Brazil, for example. And so you're always going to get some sort of weird flat earth thing going on. But we are watching a series of different experiments. The only thing is, again, the public thing gets hijacked by people going, but Sweden. And you're going, you mean the Sweden in March? Because it's the Sweden in November. They made a completely different decision, but you're still talking about Sweden in March. That kind of stuff, like but New Zealand has. My favorite of all the ridiculous conversations was the point where we're pointing out how well Ireland had done, because Ireland, being a small, cohesive country, had, you know, let's ignore the Christmas thing just for a second, but they stick a pin in that, but had basically collected together very, very well. Had done the public health message very, very well, and had controlled the initial bump very, very well. And people were pointing out, going, why can't Britain do this? These are the relative sizes of this. And people were going, population density. You're going, yes, but people in Ireland don't live in plots of land equidistant from each other. You know, they still live in cities, and the population density of London is the same as population of Dublin. Like, so this isn't the thing, but just there were levels of stupid. And so I'd like to think that it led to a huge upsurge in public health and scientific knowledge. I'm not convinced it did. And, you know, there are people like who are campaigning outside of Guy's and Thomas's, you know, saying that it was all a hoax as people were dying inside the hospital. Mm. You know, it's, you know, there, I think we have an infinite capacity for both ends of the bell curve in terms of being intelligent.
That's human nature, though, isn't it?
It is, I'm afraid, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Now, the thing is, you did manage last year to bring this book out, Is There Anybody Out There? Mm. And that is a book about space.
Two things that are irritating. Yes, it's a young people and space. And so the second book I wrote a more general book about space for kids, and I wrote another one, the book about, and this is the third science book, second about space, and this one is specifically, really the whole alien thing is partly to go into thing called exoplanets and the way we discover planets and how interesting that is. By the way, as a writer, you should be infuriated by that. There's one too many theres in the title. I only realized that after the book.
Is there anybody out there?
I mean, is there really?
Should it be, is anybody,
is
anybody
out there?
There?
Yeah.
Or is, well, you should fire your editor for a start.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, I'm responsible for this stuff. So now it bugs me every time I hear it. Never mind.
You can use that as the title for your next tour.
But it was just because there's Just the discovery of stuff is interesting.
Yeah,
the,
of course.
I have to find which one it was. One of them was announced, one of the planets, must have been Uranus, was announced by Anagram, because the guy who discovered it wanted to spread the information. We didn't discover any planets. We knew the ones that we saw all the time. And they'd wander around the sky, and hence the name planet, which is Greek for wander. And then we started discovering them again in 1738. We started discovering them again when it was 100 years. But, oh, we discovered the moons of things. It was one of the moons. It was moons of Jupiter, I think it was. They were announced by Anagram, because the astronomer discovered them. The information, you can't send the information out at the same time. So he wouldn't send a letter to somebody going, look, I've discovered the moon, in case the person would go, oh, it's funny, I have also discovered that moon, and I have sent a faster letter than you to the Royal Society to claim it. So he sent out an anagram and said, I will reveal what is in this anagram once I know you've all received the anagram. And once all the bodies received the anagram, then he sent them what the anagram was. And so he basically placeholdered the information when I've discovered something, it's hidden in here, but it was like 140 characters of Latin, so it was impossible to read. And then he sent them the key to the anagram, and they went, oh, well done, congratulations. More science should be revealed by anagram. That should happen more, that we should have just a kind of like a game of boggle wherever we discovered. I mean, it wouldn't have been helped in a public health crisis like this one had they had the Pfizer BioNTech people held back until we'd all solved the anagram. Mm-hmm. But, and vaccine, there's no vaccine anyway. Anyway, but the little things like that, like whatever, just very, very sweet stories, whatever. And it is, you know, it's aimed at creating wonder in kids. And the weird thing about it is I write them in Ireland, nobody's any problem with that. No, people, it does really well in Ireland, and people say, keep sending me photographs of their kids reading it, because in Ireland it's very, people go, oh yeah, he likes that stuff. He's probably put a bit of work into that. Like that's the thing Dara likes. So Dara probably, you know, we'll make an effort at that. Like, whereas here you hit a wall of, oh, but you're on the telly, what do you know about it? Like, as if everything you know. And it's just very, it's a kind of like a molasses thing. You've got to sweep through of like, oh, but are the children's books authors giving it to too many celebrities? You go, geez, I've been writing for 25 years. Yeah. It's sometimes it's a very cynical place, this. It's very difficult to trudge through that at times. But to my eternal joy, Ireland remains uncomplicatedly happy about there being a funny book about space that they can enjoy.
Well, it is the country that had the Young Scientist competition every year that we all grew up with.
Honestly, I have
way. Did you ever enter?
No, I never did. I never had the. I could never come up with a project for it. Went every year, walked around, chatted to people, got very shy when they were girls, and then
there were clever girls out there doing science.
Tons, like, absolutely, yeah. But I'm just, look, that wasn't the thing. It was just I was very shy. I just could never come up with a creative idea, never think to do, like, whatever. And I was good at solving the problem, but I wasn't good at, and the sort of stuff I did was very mathsy. That was my kind of stuff. It wasn't really a measurement type science-y thing. But I have toyed sometimes with, there should be one of those here. And somebody should step forward and try to organize it. But God, it's such a huge country, and you just blow your mind about how you do it. And it's, in some ways, Ireland is just the perfect size for a lot of things. And the Young Scientist is one of those. But I remember meeting three 14-year-olds in Cork, I remember, who had won it at some European thing, European science thing, a couple of years ago. And they must be now in their early 20s. The three most impressive young men I've ever met in my life. I was talking to whoever the European Commission was, Morgan Quinn, going, what's up with those three? And she's going, oh, look, they're totally going to run the place.
Very interesting to follow up, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it finds smart people, and it gives them, I mean, these three girls during their summer holidays had taken 50,000 readings on what kind of fertilizer worked best on grass, like, whatever, and had done a spectacular job of it, like, whatever. And you're going, okay, there are fabulous people coming through. So it's a great competition for that. Like, but we wouldn't be great for the science traditionally in Ireland. I mean, we do tend to emphasize more writers and artists than we do scientists. But we have an honorable enough tradition.
An awful lot of your material is generated from the difference between the two countries, Dara. I was just wondering, because there's such a long tradition of Irish comedians being so successful here, why do you think that is so? What is it that we in Ireland bring to the market here?
You know what? There's been a few, but, like, let's not get carried away with ourselves. There's probably fewer Irish comedians than there are, you know, Scouse or Mank or
I have
a kind of a bugger. We do tend to go, we are, aren't we great on the international stage? We've done so much, like, whatever. When in fact, it's like the reality is that London's just a big melting pot. So there's, like, you know, Aussie comics, Canadian comics. This is the place to do. It's a place that the world gathers to do stand up. Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of a. It's not that I think that we bring some fabulous, unique thing that they. Is that we come to here, and here is open to it. Mm-hmm. And here is very open to there being comedy from around the world, like, whatever. In a way that, for example, if you go to America, it's actually much more, because America has a kind of culture, has a dome over it, in which they see very little coming in. So if you go to America and you're standing on stage, you're like, I'm saying, what accent is that? Why are you talking that? It's a very kind of a different, you've come from a different place. There's no sense of curiosity about that. Whereas in London, there is a, just they're like, yeah, okay, grand. We're like, we're a global city and we get stuff from all over the place. So yeah, I'm very happy to see on a bill, a New Zealand comic, an Irish comic, an Australian comic, whatever, come along and do the stuff, like, whatever. So I don't think we commensurately, but it's next door to us, and it's a great place. It's just a great place to be a comic. UK, because they're like, there's a massive in normal times there's a massive circuit, and there's loads of gigs and there's loads of opportunities, and then there's a whole go to Edinburgh kind of an arc that you can do. But interestingly, fewer Irish have had the need to go over. There's more of a need when I was going over, when and before me, and up to about 10 years after me. And then, whether by example or whatever, Tommy Tiernan started doing very, very well in Ireland and just popularized it. And then I would go back then, and Des Bishop go back when you do these long runs in Vicar Street, and Ireland became a slightly more easy place to make a living doing it. Mm-hmm. And so fewer would come over for a while. It sways, waves go in and out in the nature of these things, like, whatever. But I'm always very wary of our tendency to slightly self-mythologize our enormous contribution to these things. Because, you know, it's a place that just wants lots of different voices. Mm-hmm. And it's generally very good at accepting them. I know there's a perception of Britain in the Brexit kind of a way as being very kind of closed. It really isn't. It's very kind of it's very open to other performers coming in. So yeah, the scope is there to do well here.
I wanted to ask you, since you've written this book for children, whether or not you might think about more writing for adults, more, you know, write a novel, write a sitcom, write something else. Have you thought about that?
No, look, you're right anyway, because it takes 6 months to write a stage show, and it does. So the energy put into writing a book and the energy put into writing a show are kind of the same. Maybe you need more of the book, because the physical effort of writing, actually tapping out each key, is the greatest discouragement because when you're writing for stand-up, you just talk it out. You need the same density of ideas, but you just say them. You just the conversation, and then that didn't work. I'll say it slightly differently next time, or I'll say it slightly differently next time. So you're endlessly re-editing as you do a gig. When you write when you write a stand-up show, you start with little scraps of paper with like topics. Is this a topic? Is that a topic? Is, you know, breakfast buffet a topic? Is, you know, is drinking water on a Zoom call? What is that funny? Is that funny? And you try them out in front of a small audience, and stuff that the audience latch onto, you expand them. And you expand them. So often a lot of the time is you will have a 25-minute show in June in Kilkenny, that by the time you open the show, the proper tour at the Catlass Festival, which is kind of a thing I use to test material, and I would have a 25-minute set there that would be a two-hour show by the time I got to Vicar Street in October. And on paper, same 8 topics. But they've gone from being 3 minutes each to being 10 minutes each. Or 15 minutes each, hopefully, whatever. And so weirdly, the same topics then have branched off and become things from just doing it over and over and over again, right? But that type of writing, while full of ideas and a certain sort of an effort, is effortless because you're just talking it. There's no bit where you physically have to hit the keys and you have to write the ands and the thes and the ofs. It's just flow, 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 flow. And so the bit where I've written 4 books so far in my life, each of them was at some point a slog. Because I just go, oh, Christ, do you have to actually? Yes, you do. Okay. The thing about space is, and you have to actually put the words down. So the effort, I would sooner write a show, because then I can tour it for 2 years, 2.5 years, and it'll get me to, I can do Auckland, I can do Reykjavik, whatever. I can play with it everywhere. Then sit down and write a book. Although the books are quite a satisfying thing when they're done. They're a very pleasing thing when they're done. They're very nice to go, look, that all that effort went into that, like whatever. But the process I find just much less fun than the process of writing stand-up.
No, I understand. One of the things that came across, I think, when we were doing our series on Irish writers was that some writers found this a very creative period. And they said things like, well, this is what I do. I sit in a room all day and I write. And then other people said, oh, I'm completely blocked. I'm stuck at home and I should be churning it out and I'm not. So, you know, it affects people differently. And, you know, you kind of shared how
I haven't written a joke. I haven't written a decent joke. And we did, for Mock the Week, we did some nice things, whatever, but nothing that I felt would, you know, would work for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And there is a touch of, you know, a lot of comics genuinely went, well, that's me done. Because it was so uninspiring. I think I thought, oh, well, I've got nothing else to give now. It's, you have to kind of get out of the headspace of it. But no, it feels like stasis. It feels like
it does
purgatory. So it doesn't feel like there's anything actively happening. And because there's no outlet for it, and I don't want to do a Zoom conversation with a piece of paper in my hand and go, hey, that guy and that thing there. It, really, the Zoom when we're doing Mock the Week is fine, but the Zoom just sitting in this room on my own, which is why I find that slightly depressing. And you want, weirdly, the way it actually, the ideas get written is you throw something down on the page, and then when you're on stage, the performance energy of being on stage, generally, if you start reading it out and it's going, this is going badly, you will, your brain will panic and go, well, try this instead. And some ideas will pop out. And so they all start in tiny ways and in panic and the fear of failure. But you can't recreate that in, you know, the bit that's most weird about these, about the gigs you do now, and I've done a fair few Zoom kind of after dinner-y type things or chat stuff or awards, and they tried to do versions of all these kind of things that we do, they get us to do, is that when you finish, you go, thank you very much, good night, and you press leave, the red button marked leave, and then you're in your own house, like Narnia. It's like you were suddenly in this gig, and then you're like, oh, okay, well, that's over. And that is the most disorientating of it all. That there's no kind of a, okay, that was grand. And there's no kind of slowly coming down and chatting to other comics and saying, how's that go? Or having the organizer go, that was good. Or having a drink or any of that stuff. Or milling around, chatting to people and just letting it absorb. It's being, oh, I'm in my house again. So like I can walk through that door and they're all watching telly. And that's very strange. It's like having a teleport device. Because you could disappear off and you do stuff and then, boof, you're back again, like it never happened.
Yeah.
So look, it hasn't been a help to creativity. As I said, some people, as you say, it's interesting those that can do it. But then look, there are people who get up at 6 in the morning and they're right, you know.
And not just that, Darry, but people in the creative industry generally, you know, in the theatre and in the arts world, all, you know, and younger comedians, I suppose, who are having terrible trouble trying to pay the rent or to survive financially. It is a really, really tough time for people. I mean, have you been in contact with others in dreadful situations? And
well, no, look, chapter and verse, but like, yeah, absolutely. The people, I mean, and they're trying to, there's a kind of a scrabbling around to get any work at all. And look, I mean, I'm luckier in as much as I'm in this year off, as we'll call it, immediately off the back of doing a tour. As opposed to, there was a kind of an idle game you'd play where you go, well, who's most been screwed by this? And you kind of look at acts who are about to break, about to do their first big tour, about to, you know, had just had a show commissioned, which they can't get made now, or they should be basking in the success of a thing they were just about to create and now it's just gone. And so it became this mad, they were like, had this happened 15 years earlier at the point where I was about to do my first tour, and then, oh no, you can feel that draining away, and now it's what, a year and a half later, and suddenly the theatres will all be booked, and because everyone will still, suddenly the 2 years or 3 years worth of shows will now want to fit into 1 year. And so, people will lose out. It's so the losing out of it will continue for some time. and the knock-on effect of it, like whatever. I mean, I'm the one, obviously, you get who deserves least sympathy because I was at the, I'm at the exact perfect point to be. And frankly, I was looking for a bit of a break anyway after this tour before I did the next tour. Mm. And then, like a weird monkey's paw, I said, "Wouldn't it be nice to have a year off stand-up?" And it all went too real for the world. So I'm sorry about that. It was very much my fault. You're all enjoying my Groundhog Day. So I should just, you know, find Andy McDowell and make her fall in love with me, and then we can move on with our lives. That has to happen.
I clearly haven't been watching enough television. Is there anything
How
that
have you not been watching television? We've had a year.
What have you been watching yourself? You must
everything.
Have been.
I've watched everything.
Did you say to yourself, I finally get the chance to watch Game of Thrones?
No, weirdly, I had another thing where, because I was doing a travel documentary once, and it was like 8-hour journeys from one part of Myanmar to the other. That's when I finally wanted to watch Game of Thrones. Genuinely, I downloaded and watched the entire thing in the back of a minibus. And it ended with, there's a huge battle called the Battle of the Bastards at the end of one of the series of Game of Thrones. And myself and Ed Byrne watched it together on my iPad. We put the iPad on the table and we sat in chairs and watched it. And it was not how it was intended to be seen. I've done that. I've done exactly that. But no, I caught up with if it was a decent BBC or ITV drama for the last year, I have seen it. And if I see The American Office one more time, I'll scream. I always have like a daughter who's getting into all these sitcoms. So she and I sit and we binge on sitcoms together, which is quite a sweet thing.
When you're not homeschooling.
I wouldn't know. There's been a bit of homeschooling, but that's not like, you know, it's happened. Actually, the older ones are all being looked after. The schools have been quite good. God, love it. Yes. Yeah, so no, I've caught up with my content.
So what are you looking forward to when we're all liberated? What's the first thing that you're looking forward to?
Not talking to my laptop. That'll be a huge thing. Not constantly engaging with the world via this tiny camera here. That'll be lovely. I'm looking forward to the random nature of interactions. And I mean it both on stage in terms of, hey, what do you do? And let's make up something. But also I'm looking forward to being in a bar and just bumping into somebody I hadn't seen. It's not the booze. Because I've got
you can booze at home.
Not the booze here. I'm coming down with booze. If anything, I need a break from the booze. It's just the randomness of, geez, I've not seen you in a while, as opposed to, shall we organize a Zoom chat and we can catch up and stuff, because I found my interest wanes very quickly in those. But but I'm just really need that. I need just some sort of thing, just a night that just evolves randomly would be lovely. And do you know what? To be back on tour, not for the gig, obviously for the gig, but for the bit where you check into the hotel at 2 o'clock and you go, well, I've got nothing to do it before. That'll be, I don't have to look after any kids. Oh my God, I forgot how much I just like that. I've got a sound check at 5:30. Sure, let's get some food at 5:00. And, you know, but I've got the afternoon. Oh, lovely. Let's have a look around Chester or whatever, or Reykjavik or Helsinki or whatever the hell I happen to be. Let's have a bit of an explore. And, you know, that'd be nice. To be the master of my own time again would be great.
What about relations and relatives and family members? You know, lots of people. You mentioned that you did actually get home in the summer. When I say home, you know what I mean. But a lot of people haven't. A lot of Irish people, I suppose, have not. Irish people living here have not been able to go home, and that is something I suppose a lot of people miss. What are the things that you miss, and what are the things that you're looking forward to in terms of family? Friends.
It's more that I would like them to be able to go out themselves. Not that I need to be there to see them happen. I would like my mother to get out of this lockdown that she's in at the moment. My mother's 90, so that'd be great.
Very worrying, you know, were you very, you
it
know,
was, it was worried. Until I saw how well the country was doing, and then I felt a sense of that you know, I don't feel a sense of imminent danger with them. They're at home, they're in their homes, they're not in the care or whatever the situation.
Okay.
So I don't feel at the start I was, and I was doing a lot of like, because there's, you know, a lot of, oh, look, well, be grand kind of a thing, and we're going, no, take this seriously. But actually, the country, you know, as I said, we that one crazy spike where everyone bananas at Christmas, and then the thing shot up that week, and then the country locked down again. It seems to be very much more under control. So I think Ireland's done very well generally, bar Christmas. So I'm not as frightened about it and as I was at the start. So I think they'll get through it. But I would like to go back and see, like, because we went back last summer when there was a brief window where you could stay in the one place rather than it being lit in quarantine. So we just stayed in a hotel and then we go and see them in very public, well-aired, you know, we saw a lot of Wicklow's finer gardens. Let's say, you know, there's a lot of walking around Paris Court, walking around Kilrodery, places that, you know, it's lovely to see another bush, to see another piece of topiary, as you talk to your mother. They were the conditions under which, because my sister's over there and she was kind of marking it quite carefully. So so we did that for a while. So that'd be nice. But look, I'm in contact with them. They're doing okay. But if for them, I think my mother's a very social animal. I think she'd like to be, literally same as myself, would like to be having the random interactions in the chats with people. So that would be great.
And as somebody who's lived here since around the 2002 mark, I think, I mean, what are the kind of things that you, what are the things that you miss about Ireland?
I suppose I miss the randomness, the size of it, the shared hinterland of that we're all kind of, there's a casualness about Irish people that I find very, very enjoyable, a level of acknowledgement of each other in a way that, how best to put this, I think a lot of the mythologists need to do, as you can see, I'm over it. We're uniquely, we love music. Cavemen love music. Everybody loves music, right? We don't have a unique thing on that. Oh, but we love to laugh. Everybody loves to laugh. It's like a human thing. Babies love to laugh. It's grand. So stop claiming these things, these human, it's the British do this as well. Oh, but we are very, you know, we have great fairness. Everyone likes fairness. No, it's not just a uniquely, but everyone likes fairness. There's a lot of these things that countries adopt around themselves. What I feel is a genuine thing is that we have an informality in Ireland, which I find always very, very comfortable. Sure I know you, it's grand. And we're not in, there isn't a kind of whole class thing, which is great, and or at least not as pronounced as it is here. And there's a kind of a just general needing to check in with each other, which I find, because my wife is English, we'll go if we're away on holiday somewhere, the example I was given, we were away somewhere, I don't know where it was, but we're in a hotel breakfast buffet type situation, and we're listening, and someone would walk past the table with an English accent and she would not, you know, she would not going to look up. But an Irish accent, I am like a meerkat, and I pop my head up like whatever, and I make eye contact and we nod, and there you go. And there is that urge just to check in, you know, and if they hear my, you know, well, here we are, kind of a thing, which I find quite warm as a thing, you know. There's a lot of the stuff, as I said, that I shun, a lot of the kind of more where are Irish kind of stuff that I can live without, but I just find when that's watered down into just look, we've a level of informality with each other, that I find that quite pleasing.
And do you feel very comfortable here now, of having you know made your home here and
Do
you feel very comfortable with that kind of duality of being able to go over and back and be one thing and be the other thing?
I think I need both. I think I need to be able to do that, and be able to sort of recharge it, as it were, like a video game character who needs to get their health gauge back up again. I need occasion to go back and do that. And the joy of doing things like a comedy tour is that you get to go back a lot, for example. So I get to see, I'll do like 10 weekends in Dublin on a tour. And that sounds ridiculous because I should just play a slightly bigger room or whatever and then just do them all in a box. But I then get 10 weekends in Dublin. And so I'll see college friends, school friends, you know, old mates from when I was living there in my 20s, like whatever. And I'll just get to be in the city properly. And so I get a sense of the place again. So it's a privilege I have that I get to go back and do it, see it as often as I do. I haven't for a while now, but so I feel very much more in touch. I still feel that it's moving away from me as an immigrant. You know, its passions are moving away from me, and that's the process. That's the way it goes.
Do you feel that, Darren?
Oh yeah.
How do you mean? What do you mean by that?
I think that the thing that makes you different, and the thing that makes you foreign when you go back, isn't the grand scale of things. Isn't the DNA. Your DNA doesn't change in any way. But what actually defines a nation and what they think is the day-to-day of what they talk about and what they've lived through together. So I come back and I've not been around for, I've not done this last experience with them. I wasn't there for the, you know.
The lockdown.
Yeah, but equally, I wasn't there for the last two referenda or for the, these things, mother and babies homes and all these kind of scandals. I haven't been living these things. I haven't been living who's the current, big TV phenomenon or the big pop phenomenon. That's actually weirdly, especially when you're as a comedian, that's culture. That's the thing that defines it. It's that day to day of have you noticed that now the radio stations are all doing this? That is the stuff that makes it. And that's the stuff that when you come over, after being away for 30 years, makes the place. Obviously, Stephen's Green would still look like Stephen's Green. Obviously, if you do a blood test on me, I will have the same DNA I had, whatever, 30 years ago. But all the country's shared experiences, I won't have been involved in. So it's kind of funny to feel that drift away from me. And fine, that's the way it has to be, like whatever. And sometimes it's a funny thing to joke with them about. There was a weird preponderance of, I'll say it to you, and it'll mean nothing to you. But I was in Dublin the last time I was over, and for H&R Vicar Street, I was going, look, I'll give the speech about how, you move. It's weird. I see you move apart. I see you become obsessed with things that make me feel more like an immigrant than I was. And the audience will all go, no. And I go, so basically, what's the fuck with all the donuts? And I'll get this huge applause because Dublin had 45 donut shops suddenly that appeared for 6 months and were everywhere, and you couldn't get away from donuts in Dublin. And I say this to you now to a look of obviously blank because it didn't happen in London. Dublin's like this weird petri dish of weird trends that pop up, like whatever, and they really go for them in a big way, and then they go away again.
A thing called spice bags.
Oh no, spice bags are for long. Spice bag spice bag is a thing from a chipper.
We don't have that here.
No, they don't. No, they don't do the same. Look, they don't call them, dinner boxes either here. And their curry sauce is different. Let's not get into the semiotics of chip shops. You'd be here all day.
It is lockdown. Food is about the only thing I know what you mean. I wonder if that's a generational thing, Dara, as well.
But that becomes, because in 30 years' time, I'm a generation away from knowing what the hell they're talking about, right? Mm. And so you're only, I constantly have this thing of now in between the two things, where we would have Americans come over and Americans not get the culture and what's going on here, because they were dipped in amber, they were in aspic, whatever. They were trapped in this old image of what it was used to be like. And the country keeps evolving, keep moving on, like whatever. And that's what it's supposed to do. Although my current theory, which I'm very interested in at the moment, is why it is that Irish, when they say Irish in America, it's so different to us. Irish, Bosco Irish, as I call them, people who know who Bosco is.
I know Bosco's mammy.
You're Bosco Irish. Somebody else will come and think that doesn't include us, by the way. But because there are other kids' TVs happening at the moment. Bosco Irish would be people who grew up there, as opposed to I'm Irish as in like my grandparents were Irish, right? That was my phrase I would always use. And I realized that the reason they were so different, that the Irish in America were so different to Irish, is because they define themselves as being different to other immigrant communities that they had come through America at the same time. So for the Irish in America, it was like, we're Irish, we're not Italian. We're Irish, we're not Jewish, we're not Mexican, whatever. We're Irish, we're different from these people, right? And they define their characteristics as being different from these people. Whereas the Irish in Ireland spend very little time going, I wonder what the Italians, the Jews, and the Mexicans are doing. So they haven't defined themselves in any way in relation to them. So this, when you come in and go, well, I'm Irish, which means I'm this and this, and we go, the fuck is that? It's because that means something in a cultural context that we're not in either. And so I'm trying to find a way now I'm, Irish over here, we're also drifting apart from it. So the it never stays the same. It moves, it changes, and you have to let that go. That's the joy of it. I'm very lucky I get to go back semi-regularly and watch this happen. But there are things that I see and I go, don't know who you're talking about. Don't know. I've never seen this television show. I don't know who this current celebrity is. People's careers have come and gone in the gaps between my tours. And I've come back and suddenly everyone's gone. And I'm going, who the hell was that? And said, oh yeah, that was big 6 months ago. They're gone now. It changes. It moves on. And
it does.
So I'm clinging on to it by a rock again.
I was just wondering, though, when you said about your children, obviously their mom is English and you're Irish. And how do you kind of negotiate that? It's something that a lot of people over here have to negotiate, shall we say, in terms of, how do you explain this? Or this whole Irish-English thing to them?
Their grandmother is a thing that they can dip into as they wish. I'm not raising them in a plasticky kind of way, if you know what I mean, that horrible term, but I'm not doing
horrible term.
it's a terrible term for like a, just a desire to, you know, be in touch culturally. I get that, but the but I'm not, they're not doing any of that stuff. That's, it's their own life. They'll pick their own, make their own choices. It's there for them, and it's a thing that I, you know, the only way in which we, I impose, as it were, anything in my culture is that every start of every summer we do a draw for who's going to win the hurling, and they each get two counties. And so I think my daughter won it this year. She got Limerick, and we've been to a few hurling matches, which they've enjoyed. They probably because they got sweets, and they, so they'll, things like that they'll see bits of. You know, I make a point of standing up and singing the anthem if it's played, the which is not a, a pleasant experience. But I don't, I'm like, I'm not, they're not being raised in a kind of a Irish and abroad kind of a way. It's there for them to take from and draw from and use as they will. I mean, they're going to be spelling their names for the rest of their lives, but there you go.
And did you give them Irish names?
Oh yeah, I mean, because they're O'Brien anyway, so they have to, you might as well go the whole hog, like, so they, so, oh no, there's shavus and everything. They are still there in massive trouble. But it's so we don't do that. And then my wife's from Yorkshire, which is kind of an interesting cultural thing in itself, separate from, like, you know, people from Yorkshire regard themselves as being a kind of a separate cultural and national identity anyway. So that happens. It's only kind of weird things like, for example, those sweets that round trees used to do, the fruit, what are they called again? Oh, you know, the
round fruit pastilles.
Thank you. What, say that word again.
Pastilles.
There we go. An Irish person says pastille. I was just testing you there. A British people say pastels, fruit pastels.
Well, scone's gone, you know.
You know, but I, you know, it's more, this one's correct, because a pastille is, I even looked up while they were laughing at me, because I was talking about fruit pastilles, and it said, it's pastels. I said, it's pastilles. And I'm looking it up going, and it's on the website of Roundtree going, well, pastille was obviously named after the French word pastille, which rhymes with Bastille, right? And I'm reading this to them, and they don't, do not care. And I said, but a Yorkshire pronunciation, because Roundtree's in York, always pronounces it as pastels. So that's what it's there. And so we have this conversation, but like little things like that, little shibboleths like that appear, where I will come at them with the Irish slash correct thing, and they will go, no. Like the letter R or the letter OR, as we say it, that kind of stuff. They're little snag points, which are kind of funny to have. Little points of tension in a family, which are quite nice. Look, it's there for them to draw from.
Yes, yes, absolutely. It's like those the internet quizzes, 15 things you'll only know if you're Irish. Question one, what is a hot press?
Exactly, that kind of stuff. I don't know how well they do. They might buy... Just by, you know, I was going to say by immersion, but it's by induction, whatever the first, osmosis. They might pick up a few of those kind of things, like whatever. But this is, you know, one of the joys of it. I mean, there is a thing that we may make a documentary for the BBC, a travel documentary in Ireland. We may do one at some stage, this talk of doing something. And the whole point I would do would be things that are perfectly normal in Ireland, but foreign for here. And use that as a basis for it, like whatever stuff that you just, we're not some Tirador or Wonderland, but we are different. We're a different country with different this, and this, like whatever. And so I think that's an important thing to assert every so often in case, you know, here they just become, oh, you're just Irish. That's just like here. No. So there you go.
There's just one final thing I wanted to ask you, Dara. It's on a personal matter. You did an interview recently in which you talked about the search for your birth mother, and you mentioned there about the mother and baby homes. And I'm conscious that if there was somebody watching this who might be an admirer of yours and who might be thinking of going on the same process, is there any word of advice that you'd give to them?
Well, let's start. If you're considering doing this, like whatever, I'm sort of in the middle of doing it, and I came did an interview about it recently. Deliberately to just get it done, say it, you know, whatever. And as a point, thank you for not bringing it till now, because I generally don't want to go over the whole story again.
No, you don't want to be defined by it. No,
but also it's kind of a thing that I've spoken
about. But it's out there now.
It's out there now. It's grand. It's fine. And what it allows me to do is I may do one or two things where I explain parts of the story, and I may then see if it's a story that I can tell in a way that, you know, on stage, and see if I can draw out the bits of it, like whatever. So it's out there. It's not a big surprise or a big reveal. But also the other advantage of doing it is that there was a campaign in Ireland for adoptees to get their birth cert, which is bizarrely not available to them now. If you apply to get information as an adopted person in Ireland, you receive a redacted form of information. And you literally receive sheets of things with the word redacted written on them and all the information blanked out. And I know people who have gone so far as to be in contact with their birth parents, or at least and even then aren't allowed to get the information about themselves. And they're going, but no, I brought her along. We're the two people mentioned in that kind of, you know, not quite that, but there is an element to it. Like, it's a ridiculous thing. Interestingly, if you're in the UK and these situations, you can, because the law apparently allows you to, if you've moved to the UK, allows you to get your birth certificate in Ireland. I think that's the case, right? But if you're in Ireland, no. If I was giving any advice to somebody, it would be start the process now, because it's a slow process. It takes time. And given that the information is held by another body and they won't tell you anything, you need them to be, they will help you. And actually, a lot of the help they give you is very good, because sometimes it's good to put the brakes on it. It's good to have somebody going, okay, managing your expectation about how this will work and what will occur here. But it is also frustrating to be at arm's length and to be talking to somebody and then to know that they are literally reading your birth cert, but you can't have it. And that is frustrating. So that's the campaign we're trying to change it. There are ways of doing detective work. If you can get some of it, like specifically your first name, then you can find it. And they're in the most Irish way. That's the most Irish thing we have, an Irish solution to an Irish problem. When you go to find it, they know what you're doing and they really want to help you, but they know they can't just help you. So they have to encourage you, gee you along to do it. But there's a room you can go to with all the births of everything, and you can hunt it down. But you probably won't get your first name because of GDPR, of all things. So there's a series of obstacles put in the way of people trying to find their birth parents in Ireland. And part of the reason, I think, is if you open all the information up, you'd find out just how much stuff was missing anyway, and how much stuff was obscured or obfuscated or just made absent. Like, I mean, there's not a lot of information about birth fathers at all. If anything, they're entirely written out of the process. It would be a thing that, you know, at all times, the best time to start the process is now. And then as it's going, trust me, you'll have plenty of time to deal with your emotions and feelings about it, because it will take a long time. So it's not like it's going to happen quickly. So, it can be weird. And also when you're living in this era where you think, well, I can just find out something, I'll just tap, 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 and it'll all be there. It's not. And that is bizarre, and it feels really weird in this day and age that you can't just, well, I'll just tap it in now. I'm sure there's a database, and I'll just type in, bang, there we go. No, there's genuinely a need to slowly go through this. So it's weird. I don't think it would make any harm for them a bit more sunlight let in on this. And the current thing in Ireland with the mother and baby homes has only accelerated that need.
Absolutely. Do you feel yourself, I know you said it's a process that you're still going through and it's early days yet, but do you feel that it's kind of changed in any way, or made you more, I don't know, reflective or...
I don't know, the process has, but it has put a cast of other characters into my life, which is an interesting thing. But look, as I say, we were kind of in the midst of it all. It was all happening, and then COVID happened, and it's all kind of been put on hold. And so it's very difficult to actually get, you can't meet anyone, for example. So that's kind of a slow thing. But but I have had contact with a sister and a brother and some people that they... You know, and my birth mother, and it'll more of that kind of normalizing would happen if it was possibly in the same room as them, but I can't. So look, I'm kind of keeping it kind of light in terms of detail.
Of course, but in terms of people, I suppose, you know, the fact that you are in the public eye, it almost, you know, it does I suppose have an impact on anybody watching, in the same way as I think you said that the film Philomena had an influence on
it.
You
did. I mean, it was one of the reasons that I did this is because I saw, because I you know about this and you're in your chart and you're kind of going, well, do I want to do this search? And then I realized from watching Philomena that I actually had a responsibility to a certain extent to contact my birth mother and go, look, it worked out, I've got great parents and we have a fantastic relationship and that was all very fine, but you know, just so you know, that would be a case, like whatever. So that was actually a more of a nudge, not only is it a story that you can find out about yourself, but you possibly have a responsibility, I don't want to put any pressure on anyone in this, but like, you can do this, you can actively do this, and you can actually answer a question for somebody else as well. It's not just a question for you, but it's a question for somebody else as well. And so that was a strange feeling of, oh my God, I haven't had that tilted on its axis. And for it just not to be an idle curiosity of mine, as much as it is also a responsibility I might have. So, you know, but again, look, you don't want to put everyone's journey in this is very, very different. Mine came from an incredibly secure emotional place. It was never, I never felt that it was part of my identity. I don't suddenly feel I'm a different person for having discovered what I've discovered. There's a line I put down when I was talking to somebody going, it answers nothing in the sense of you keep thinking, well, maybe this is why I'm tall, I'm bald, I'm into science or whatever. Yeah. None of that. It doesn't any of that. When you meet people, they're not like some cartoon version exactly the same of you. Like, oh my God, how did I not see this before? Like, whatever. They're just other people. They're just these other people who you have this kind of like, oh, okay, hi. So it's not like it does, for me anyway, there was a jigsaw piece missing and then I found that piece and put it into the, it's not that kind of neat resolution. It's just, it feels like more threads woven into a tapestry.
That's a very nice way of putting it. And I think probably you've had enough of being on Zoom now at this point.
You know, honestly, in both in the macro sense and in the micro sense, it'd be nice to do any of this face to face. That'd be a delight.
Yes. And we hope, you know, that one day you will join us down in the Irish Cultural Centre in Hammersmith.
Look, my huge, there's two things I've done in the Irish Cultural Centre that are outstanding for me. I've had various evenings there, but I get blood there. For the first time in the UK, I think a trend I've continued, but they've moved it now from the Irish Cultural Centre to weirdly the church in Hammersmith. So I'd given blood on the altar, which felt almost satanic, but it was just a kind of that was a room that was available. And also I met Enda Kenny there, the Irish Taoiseach who happened to be over, and I walked in and I think he was doing so hello to him, like whatever. So I have a very weird scattered collection of experiences in that room. Here's to more of them. Here's to more weird scattered
collections. We'll try and make it as random as possible.
That's all I ask. All I ask is I walk in and go, geez, what are you doing here? Let's have a pint. That's all I ask.
We'll give you a pint anyway. That'll relax you. Dara O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us today. And the best of luck. We look forward to seeing you in the flesh.
Lovely. Salam.
All the best.